Straight Talk from Israel.
You're listening to Israel News Talk Radio. And now, here is Walter Bingham.
Hello and welcome to the program. It's August 14th, 2018, and in our calendar, the 3rd of Elul, 5778. I am Walter Bingham. My number for this week is 575, the answer at the end. And so pleased to be able to be with you for the next hour that I moved my announced break to next week, because I have an interesting program for you. There's great upheaval in the internal politics of the United Kingdom. The Conservative government doesn't know if it's coming or going with their policy about Brexit, that's their plan to part from the European Community, and the Labour Party, with Jeremy Corbyn at the helm, is split about their policy on anti-Semitism. And that's the subject with which I start. Also in the programme is a report, or rather pictures in sound, from the largest synagogue in the world. For some time now, the British Labour Party, who are the official opposition to Her Majesty's government in the UK, has been in turmoil, accused of institutional anti-Semitism, and that their leader, Jeremy Corbyn, does nothing actively to eradicate this situation. In fact, he's been accused to have been sitting on the sidelines for the past 3 years. There have been massive demonstrations by Jews and non-Jews alike against his lack of action. In fact, there's a rift between Labour's National Executive and the Labour Members of Parliament, who are urging the leadership of the party to accept and comply with the IHRA definition of anti-Semitism. That's the International Holocaust Remembrance Alliance. The Office of Democratic Institutions and Human Rights has applied this as working definition of anti-Semitism, in which they collaborated with the European Monitoring Center on Racism and Xenophobia, with the Jewish organizations like the American Jewish Committee, the European Jewish Congress, Yad Vashem, and other major Jewish NGOs and prominent academics. This working definition encompasses both traditional and contemporary manifestations of anti-Semitism. It's quite long, but I shall read it for you. So, stay tuned for this and the most interesting interview to follow.
Always challenging the status quo. Hello, I'm Rod Bryant on Beyond the Matrix here at IsraelNewsTalkRadio.com. I want to encourage you to listen each week, every Wednesday at the same time, for an amazing show that will challenge you, inform you, and inspire news, views, and wisdom for the nations. Here on IsraelNewsTalkRadio.com, don't forget Beyond the Matrix every week, Wednesday, here on IsraelNewsTalkRadio.com.
And now, here is Walter Bingham.
Welcome back. First, the definition. Anti-Semitism is a certain perception of Jews which may be expressed as hatred towards Jews. Rhetorical and physical manifestations of anti-Semitism are directed towards Jewish or non-Jewish individuals and or their property, towards Jewish community institutions and religious facilities. In addition, such manifestations could also target the State of Israel, conceived as a Jewish collectivity. Anti-Semitism frequently charges Jews with conspiring to harm humanity, and it is often used to blame Jews for why things go wrong. It's expressed in speech, writing, visual forms and action, and employs sinister stereotypes and negative character traits. Contemporary examples of anti-Semitism in public life, the media, schools, the workplace, and in the religious sphere could, taking into account the overall context, include, but are not limited to, calling for aiding or justifying the killing or harming of Jews in the name of radical theology or an extremist view of religion. Making mendacious, dehumanizing, demonizing, or stereotypical allegations about Jews as such, or the power of Jews as a collective, such as, especially but not exclusively, the myth about a world Jewish conspiracy, or of Jews controlling the media, economy, government, or other societal institutions. Accusing Jews as people of being responsible for real or imagined wrongdoing, committed by a single Jewish person or group, or even for acts committed by non-Jews. Denying the fact, scope, mechanism, for instance gas chambers, or intentionality of the genocide of Jewish people at the hands of National Socialist Germany and its supporters and accomplices during World War II, the Holocaust. Accusing the Jews as a people or Israel as a state of inventing or exaggerating the Holocaust. Accusing Jewish citizens of being more loyal to Israel or to the alleged priorities of Jews worldwide than to the interests of their own nations. Examples of the ways in which antisemitism manifests itself with regard to the state of Israel, taking into account the overall context, could include denying the Jewish people their right to self-determination, for instance, by claiming that the existence of the State of Israel is a racist endeavor, applying double standards by requiring of it a behavior not expected or demanded of any other democratic nation, using the symbols and images associated with classic antisemitism, for instance, claims of Jews killing Jesus or blood libel, to characterize Israel or Israelis, drawing comparisons of contemporary Israeli policy to that of the Nazis, holding Jews collectively responsible for actions of the State of Israel. However, criticism of Israel, similar to that leveled against any other country, cannot be regarded as antisemitic. In order to get a better understanding of the situation, I have on the telephone from London the editor of the Jewish News, Richard Ferrer. Thank you for joining the program.
My pleasure.
What we hear on the news about the Labour Party in Britain is very disturbing. In fact, a couple of weeks ago, all three major Jewish newspapers carried the same front page, "United We Stand." What's going on?
Well, that front page that you referred to really was the culmination, I think, of 3 years of concerns building up ever since Jeremy Corbyn became leader of the party. It's quite clear, I think, at this point that a Jeremy Corbyn-led British government would pose a threat to the Jewish community and Jewish life in Britain, simply for the fact that he's so cynical and tactical when it comes to even not apologising, but clarifying where he stands in terms of his relationships with people that wish to undermine Jewish life, undermine the state of Israel. He is a very difficult person to pin down and a very difficult person to clarify in terms of his motivations and what it is that he is looking to achieve.
Even the deputy leader of the Labour Party, Tom Watson, voiced very strong criticism of his leader, saying that the Labour Party faced shame and would disappear into a vortex of eternal shame and render itself unfit to lead if it doesn't tackle antisemitism. Was that a bid at the leadership, you think?
I don't think that was a bit of the leadership. What I think it symbolises is the fact that the Labour Party under Jeremy Corbyn is splitting. It's splitting from the hard left that Jeremy Corbyn is the champion of to somewhere just left of centre that Tom Watson represents. There's a huge schism appearing, and I think it's being fought over through this anti-Semitism crisis. There's a lot of good people in the Labour Party, a lot of people that I suppose you could still refer to loosely as Blairites, people like Luciana Berger, Ruth Smith, I wouldn't put Tom Watson in that category, but these are people that are coalescing around a centre ground that see anti-Semitism for what it truly is, which is a great danger in their party. And then you have the Momentum organisation, which has propelled Jeremy Corbyn to power, which looks upon anti-Semitism as just something that potentially they have to get over in order to achieve their great ambition, which of course is to become the next government.
Just explain Momentum.
So Momentum is a grassroots organisation launched 2 or 3 years ago to propel Jeremy Corbyn and the Corbyn Project into power. So it's a left of centre, some will call it militant organisation, that looks upon the Tony Blair years as a betrayal of Labour values, sees it basically as losing its roots. It has its roots very similar to the militant tendency of the early 1980s when you had Michael Foot, Arthur Scargill and the unions taking great power and taking over the Labour Party. What happened there is that heralded in the Thatcher years. This was an ethos that the British voters were not interested in, and it held over a decade of Thatcherism and about 18 years of Tory government. So the Jewish community, I think, is quite clear that there is a danger here that Jeremy Corbyn could become Prime Minister, not on the strength of his proposals and his policies, but simply because the current government under Theresa May, and with the whole Brexit EU thing, is an absolute shambles.
You mentioned a few names of members of his party before. Then there was the case of a proposed disciplinary hearing of Margaret Hodge, who accused Corbyn of being an anti-Semite. And now that decision has been reversed. What caused that reversal?
This was an extraordinary situation. Dame Margaret Hodge, who is a former cabinet minister, very senior politician. And we have now got to the situation in Britain where a senior Labour Party member of Parliament can call her own leader of her party an anti-Semite and a racist to his face and receive no punishment. So the situation we've found is that there was going to be a big split if Margaret Hodge and also another MP for the Labour Party called Ian Austin, who had another similar disciplinary hearing hanging over his head.
Has that been dropped?
The Ian Austin one has not been dropped. He had a very, very frank exchange of views with a senior Labour member, and he's still under investigation. Mm-hmm. But I think the Labour Party was forced to drop Margaret Hodge. Some of the people closest to Jeremy Corbyn absolutely did not want that to happen and wanted her to pay, wanted her to be punished. But I think they averted a catastrophe inside the Labour Party by saying, all right, let's just forget this, let's all move on. Margaret Hodge has not apologised. And as far as we're concerned, she still thinks that the leader of her party is an anti-Semite. That's where we are currently in British politics today.
So does the fact that Corbyn conflates his criticism of the policies of the state of Israel with it being the Jewish state, does that mean that he is an anti-Semite, or is he anti-Semitic, period?
He attracts anti-Semites. Anti-Semites are drawn to him. Anti-Semites join the Labour Party because of him. And he's got a lot of skeletons in his closet, and they're coming out every single day. Now, there's been all sorts of things like the anti-Semitic mural that he liked on Facebook, on social media. So many of his MPs and councillors and grassroots members are being investigated for saying and tweeting and posting appalling things. And it all boils down to what you mentioned at the top of this section, this IHRA definition, and Labour's refusal to adopt this standard definition of what anti-Semitism is. It's internationally recognised. 130 councils across the UK, the Crown Prosecution Service, the police, the government, the Welsh Assembly, the Scottish Parliament, they all accept IHRA, but Labour will only accept it with a few caveats that allow them to attack Israel.
Then there's that peculiar case of Peter Wildsman, who makes these anti-Semitic statements, and there's no sign of any investigation into what he does.
The problems just keep piling up, don't they? So Peter Wildsman is a member of the NEC, which is the main body of the Labour Party, the non-political executive wing. He's up for an election now to be re-elected. And in a meeting a couple of weeks ago, it was heard that he called, he would not be swayed by Jewish Trump fanatics. which of course is a terrible thing for anyone to say, and he was rejecting and denying that there was ever a problem with anti-Semitism in his party. It's not clear as to whether Jenny Formby, who is one of the heads of the Labour Party, a non-political head of the Labour Party, and Jeremy Corbyn himself were actually in the room at the time and said and did nothing. This is a problem that goes to the absolute heart of the Labour Party's organisation. It's not a problem on the fringes. It's now affected the absolute heart of the political party.
Even Tom Watson, the assistant leader of the Labour Party, even excused Peter Wilsman by just calling him a loudmouth bully. That's not very sharp, is it?
Well, I think there's obviously some previous issues between those two. Tom Watson's clearly known this man for a long time and thinks that saying something like Jewish Trump fanatics is really in keeping with his character. Wilsman is to the far left of the Labour Party and Tom Watson is probably just to the left of the Labour Party. So I think ideologically they're coming from different positions.
There's more.
Hi, I'm Rabbi David Aaron. The soul basics are the most profound, the most essential, and yet often the most neglected in our education. Join me for Soul Talk on Israel's News Talk Radio and discover the secrets to love, spiritual growth, and personal power.
Here is Walter Bingham.
Richard, then there was an interesting case about a British blogger and singer called Alison Chablos, who already in 2016 said, "The Shoah is a gigantic accumulation of nonsense. Auschwitz is a theme park. Most camp inmates died of typhoid. And the gas chambers killed lice, not humans." As far as I know, there was never a prosecution, or was there?
Yeah, Alison appeared in court. It was a case brought by the Campaign Against Anti-Semitism, which is a very effective lobby group in this country. She was in court a few weeks ago. She is basically a singer who mocks Jews and mocks the Holocaust. She's a Holocaust denier, and she makes these most appalling songs about Anne Frank and Elie Wiesel, and she puts them to the tunes of Hava Nagila. I mean, this is really pernicious, vile, nasty stuff in which she questions anything to do with the Holocaust. And she has her own little group. I don't know what motivates her. I mean, clearly coming from a very dark place, and she enjoys provoking and insulting the Jewish community. So she got this suspended sentence. I think it was something like 3 months.
Slap on the wrist.
And if she repeats any of this in the future, then hopefully the punishment will be more serious.
Now, Corbyn does not support the additional sanctions against Iran and is very vocal for the Palestinian Arab side in their conflict with Israel. Does that make him popular enough in the country so that the Labour Party has any chance in the next election, which could be very soon for reasons connected with the Brexit negotiations?
I'm not entirely sure how much foreign policy will play to the voters when there is another general election. The Iran and the Palestinian cause is something that, you know, your average voter in Leeds, Liverpool or Birmingham is going to be that bothered about. I certainly think, of course, it will affect the Jewish community, but they are less than 300,000 and they are kind of coalesced around northwest London generally. But yes, the IHRA issue, I think, is the nub of it. And in early September, the party is going to finally rubber stamp that one way or the other. They're either going to finally hold their hands up and say, fine, we accept the whole thing. This is the start of building bridges with the Jewish community again. Or they'll reject it. And then I think that's the end of relationships between the Jewish community and Jeremy Corbyn.
So for decades, the Labour Party has been considered to be the natural political home for British Jews. But since their public display of anti-Semitism, even some Jewish hardliners have in recent months distanced themselves from Labour. And recent local authority elections in Jewish areas have shown that trend.
Absolutely. The Labour Party has been abandoned by the Jewish community. It was the natural home of Jews voting in Britain. I voted Labour in the past. I'd say the previous leader, Ed Miliband, had problems with the community, despite being Jewish himself. But Jews still, I think, rallied around his cause broadly. His predecessor, Gordon Brown, and his predecessor, Tony Blair, they were hugely popular in terms of the Jewish community and their sympathies towards anti-Semitism and racism and religious freedom in this country. So I think at the last election, less than 7% of the Jewish community voted for Labour and Jeremy Corbyn, whereas before, you know, that number's up to around 40, 50% and even higher.
Wow, this is a most significant drop.
And it's the same in the States. Jews tend to typically vote Democrat. So it's a trend has stopped, and I hope one day that I, as a British Jew, will feel comfortable voting for Labour again.
Will you vote Labour next time?
No, it's safe to say I will not be voting Labour till the Labour Party starts to get a grip of its own issues and talk in ways that genuinely and sincerely rebuild bridges and trust with
so
me.
We can take that as the pattern for British Jews in general in the next election.
Absolutely. Hopefully there won't be an election for 4 years, and that's a long time. You know, a day's a long time in politics.
Of course.
4 years, who knows? But there is turmoil currently in the government. Theresa May is pushing for this soft Brexit, and the people around her who are resigning are pushing for an absolute Brexit and want to leave even if there's no deal. And there is, I think, going to be an issue in September, October when we have the party conferences.
We'll talk about Brexit another time. That's a subject on its own. Jeremy Corbyn made a number of efforts at apologising for what goes on regarding anti-Semitism in the party, but they always sounded hollow and are phrased to address just the act of hurt. He actually mentions hurt rather than the expressions of anti-Semitism per se, and he doesn't shy away from insulting his Jewish Labour parliamentarians, as he did to Dame Louise Ellman, calling her the honorary member for Tel Aviv. But Corbyn claims he is not an anti-Semite. Do his actions, or rather inactions, not belie his claims?
Well, I think you've really hit the nail on the head there. Whenever he acknowledges hurt, he speaks in sweeping generalizations, he speaks in the broadest terms. There is never any mention of his own conduct. There's never any mention of, yes, I probably shouldn't have called those people in Hamas and Hezbollah my friends. You know, I probably should have done more over the whole Ken Livingstone thing, who was allowed for 3 years to continue, only suspended despite saying Hitler supported Zionism. I should have done so much more when it came to this Chakrabarti inquiry into anti-Semitism, which was clearly a sham and something that didn't actually achieve anything because it's got worse ever since. There are so many things he's culpable of. There's so many things he's personally responsible for. There's so much he's done to cause the problem, but there's no mention of it. He never uses I or me in anything he says. It's always I've fought anti-Semitism all my life. I've always been an advocate for religious freedom. It's as broad and general as you could possibly get, and that is not a sincere apology.
So should Corbyn be replaced in the Labour Party?
Well, if Corbyn is replaced in the Labour Party, it will only be to be replaced with somebody else and probably someone even more militant and hardcore. The Labour Party is lost now to the hard left. There is no centre-left party with any power in British politics anymore. Ever since Corbyn was propelled to power, he has created this wing of the Labour Party that controls everything else. So, I mean, there's talk about deselecting centre-left MPs. There are Jewish MPs that are wondering whether they should quit the party before the next election rather than help Jeremy Corbyn become Prime Minister. There's even talk this week of a Lib Lab, that's Liberal Labour coalition forming, which would be a big split away from the Labour Party and the creation of a new party. So I think whether Corbyn is in power in the Labour Party or not, it's kind of irrelevant now, really, because the Labour Party of the days of Tony Blair and Gordon Brown are over.
You mentioned the upheaval in the Conservative government with Theresa May, and now we have this in the Labour Party. What's the general atmosphere in the UK vis-a-vis Jews?
Oh, the general atmosphere is still very healthy. I mean, I've lived in Britain all my 47 years. It's a wonderful place to be Jewish. It's a wonderful place to express your own individuality. It's a very pluralistic and accepting society, especially in London. That's why Jewish life is thriving. Jewish schools, community centres, shuls, they're all in a healthy position. Now, of course, Jews have to go to synagogue behind, you know, CCTV and barbed wire fences, and there is security issues. But thankfully, those are still limited. It's not the same problem that there is in Europe, particularly in places like France, where the Jewish community is facing a far worse, even more violent threat. Violence against Jews in this country is mercifully rare. CST, the Community Security Trust that publishes figures on anti-Semitism, just published its last 6 months figures, and they are down on the previous 6 months, so that's cause for hope. And there wasn't a single incident of actual physical violence. It was all against property and online and graffiti, etc. So, no, generally, life in Britain for Jews is still pleasant and still open, and long may that continue. But under a Corbyn government, things might start to get a little bit concerning.
Now, would that then cause an existential threat to Jews in the UK?
Well, that was the word that the three Jewish newspapers, including mine, used: existential threat. Let's take a look. Jeremy Corbyn becomes Prime Minister. His party haven't accepted full IHRA, so that means you can call a Jew more loyal to Israel than their own country. You can say Israel's a racist endeavour. That then becomes government policy. Then the police have to follow that lead. So you can't prosecute people for saying that. Then things get intolerable online. Then you start arresting Israeli politicians if they come over to the UK. The heads of Hamas and Hezbollah turn up at number 10 Downing Street for talks because they're his friends. Imagine that. Then does he follow the boycott and divestment sanction campaign? Does that become something that's passed through law? And on and on and on it goes. What happens about Shechita? What happens about funding for Jewish schools? Are Jewish schools allowed to associate with Israel anymore, seeing as it's a racist endeavour? And on it goes. It's a terrifying picture.
Well, on this bleak note, we have to end. Richard Ferrer, editor of the Jewish News, thank you for your time. Jeremy Corbyn acknowledged that Labour has been too slow in processing disciplinary cases of anti-Semitic abuse, but insisted that was changing. Well, it seems that this is hollow talk, although he wrote in the Guardian newspaper that, and I quote, Labour staff have seen examples of Holocaust denials, crude stereotypes of Jewish bankers, conspiracy theorists blaming 9/11 on Israel, and even one individual who appeared to believe that Hitler has been misunderstood. People holding those views have no place in the Labour Party, and although he claims that the number of cases was few, Corbyn said one is too many, and stressed, interestingly, that it was not done in his name. I'd be interested what you think about it all, so please write to me or leave your notes on the comment pages. If necessary, I'll reply to you. After this break, we'll change subject and the mood, so stay tuned.
You're listening to Israel News Talk Radio.
This is Shai Ben-Tekoa, and each week I'll be webcasting to you from Judea, origin of the word Jew, a people besieged and beleaguered in every generation. Nazi Germany is but a memory, but in its place the world invented the phantom Palestinians as this generation's internationally authorized Jew killers. Tune in for a different slant on life in Israel, Phantom Nation, every Monday.
And now, here is Walter Bingham.
Jeremy Corbyn acknowledged that Labour has been too slow in processing disciplinary cases of anti-Semitic abuse, but insisted that was changing. Well, it seems that this is hollow talk, although he wrote in the Guardian newspaper that, and I quote, Labour staff have seen examples of Holocaust denials, crude stereotypes of Jewish bankers, conspiracy theorists blaming 9/11 on Israel, and even one individual who appeared to believe that Hitler has been misunderstood. People holding those views have no place in the Labour Party, and although he claims that the number of cases was few, Corbyn said one is too many, and stressed, interestingly, that it was not done in his name. I'd be interested what you think about it all, so please write to me, or leave your notes on the comment pages. If necessary, I'll reply to you. And now, we'll change the subject and the mood. Do you know where the largest synagogue is in the world? Well, I was there. According to the old joke, everything in the United States is bigger and better.
But I'm afraid not this time. It's right here in the holy city of Jerusalem, and it's the world center of the Belzer Hasidim. Standing at the gate, I looked in wonderment at this imposing building and didn't even notice that my guide had arrived and stood next to me until he spoke. He was Yecheskel Friedman, a Belzer Chosid himself, who usually conducts tours and knows everything there is to know about the history of his movement and, of course, about this building. Modesty prevents him from dressing in anything more colorful than black and a white shirt, and his traditional clothing lent authenticity to this impressive edifice. I asked him first about the building.
In 1984, that was a groundbreaking ceremony, straight after the Yom Tov of Shavuos. They had to dig out the whole mountain. This is built on a mountain, which is the Kiryat Belz community area. So in 1986, they actually started building. As they completed each floor, straight away it was in use, and this section of the shul, which we're going to see right now, which is what we call the Shabbos section, which is used only for the Shabbat and for the Yom Tov, and when there's a lot of people, that was started to built in 1996 and completed in 2000. The shul actually altogether is 13 stories high. In use is 10 stories, and then the 11th, 12th, and 13th is just in height. The height of the building from where we're standing on the outside, it's 22 or 23 meters high. That's from the 6th floor up till the 13th floor.
The building is enormous. How was it financed?
For the Belzer Chassidim, this was like a dream come true that we should rebuild the Belzer Shul, which was destroyed in the Holocaust. But us Belzer Chassidim, it was a tremendous chus and a merit to be able to give money towards building the shul. Now, since the building of the shul actually spanned a 16-year period, so by all the Belzer Chassidim wholeheartedly giving money over the 16 years, that's how the shul was financed. But altogether, it was built by donations from Belzer Chassidim worldwide.
After this brief overview, it was time to step inside. The first area we entered is an enormous hall which seems to cover the whole floor area of this synagogue.
Yes, well, you actually walked in the 6th floor of the building, the Polish and Yiddish anteroom of the shul, the lobby. And this serves as a connecting point between the lower floors where you have the mikveh and the coffee rooms and all the tremendous library and all the shtibulach, as it's called. And here they could take off their coats and hang it up, and then they go up to the shul. On this floor, there's also a remembrance room as a remembrance to the shul in Belz going back 200 years. The whole purpose of this shul is to consecrate the memory of the shul in Belz built by the first Belzer Rebbe. In this remembrance room, we'll have the memories of all the Belzer Hasidim that were murdered by the Nazis. Their memories and their names and their families and their history will be preserved and documented and put up in this room called the Heichal Zikuron, which is like the Yad Vashem for the Belzer community. Also, the history of the Belzer Shul in Belz will be documented there as well, with pictures, etc. And people which lost their loved ones in the war will be able to come here on the day of the Yortzeit to be with their memories and to light candles and learn Mishnayot, etc. That's how the shul is financed, by donations worldwide.
Let's go and see the main sanctuary. I now stepped into the main shul, the main sanctuary, and for a moment I had to hold my breath, because it gave me the feeling as if I had stepped into the third Beit HaMikdash, the Jewish Holy Temple. The size alone is awe-inspiring. How many people does it seat?
This shul seats on this floor, which is the seventh floor of the building, the main floor of the sanctuary, the men's section, 1,954 seats. You will see there are six separate galleries. Altogether, the seating capacity of the shul is 5,000 seats, plus there's plenty of place for standing as well. And on a regular Shabbat, the lower floor where we're standing now is full, and the upstairs is more empty. When there's a bigger Shabbat, like Shabbat Chanukah or Purim or things like that, when people come from all over Israel to be with the Rebbe, then we'd open up the upper galleries for men. That's besides four galleries for ladies. So altogether 5,000 seats, the seating capacity, with plenty of places to stand as well. And on Rosh Hashanah, the high holy days, with bells of chassidim from all over the world come to the shul, the place is so jam-packed you can't put a needle into the shul, and then you'd have in this building between 7,500 to 8,000 people at one time.
Let me just describe to you what I see as I step in. Looking up at the ceiling, which of course is magnificently decorated, from it there hang some chandeliers. What have we got here?
You might think there are eight smaller chandeliers and one large one hanging down. They're actually all the same size. It's just an optical illusion, because the middle chandelier is hanging down much lower than the other ones. Besides the beauty in them, they actually serve a very important purpose, which is the acoustics. Now, of course, in an Orthodox shul, there are no microphones on Shabbat, so to be able to hear the one which leads the prayers would be an impossible feat unless the acoustics were amazingly successful, which, Baruch Hashem, they are. If you take a look at the walls, you'll see the walls are slanted in on all sides, which brings the voice down into the shul instead of it bouncing back and forth. And that's where the chandeliers come in as well, because the three-tiered shape of each chandelier brings the voice underneath, it sends the voice underneath the galleries. Plus, each chandelier is covered with a crystal plate over the entire circumference, which makes like a lower false roof, so the voice doesn't actually travel to the roof, which is 20 meters high. And back down, it hits the chandeliers, and that spreads it around the shul. And that's why the middle chandelier, which incidentally each chandelier is over 5 meters tall, which is 17 feet approximately, and they weigh 700 kilo, that's in pounds, like 1600. And the middle chandelier, which is lower down, that is to spread the voice of the one that reads from the Torah. His voice hits that particular chandelier and spreads its voice around the whole shul.
The Torah is read, of course, from a stand, we call it a bima, in the center, and that seems to me twice the size of any other ones I've ever seen.
Yes, it starts a meter above the ground, so that everyone should be able to see and hear, and since all the main functions of a shul, like the blowing of the shofar and things like that, take place on the bima, so it's very important everyone should be able to see and know what's going on. Besides that, if there's a circumcision on Shabbos, it takes place on the bima as well. The Aron Kodesh, we talk about the Holy Ark. This Holy Ark is the biggest Holy Ark in the world. It's in the Guinness Book of Records. It weighs 23 tons. It's made of Brazilian wood, specially imported from Brazil, walnut oak. And it was hand-carved here in Eretz Israel, in Israel, by a religious company called Achim Fried in Kiryat Gat. It only has a floral design all over the Holy Ark, and that's being because in bells they had no words inscribed or engraved on the Aron Kodesh or on the curtain or even on the covers of the Torah. There are no words, just they have designs. As it was in the Beis HaMikdash, there were no words on anything, any part of the building. Besides that, there is place for 70 Sifrei Torah, 70 Torah scrolls in the Aron Kodesh. Even the curtain covering the Aron Kodesh has special meanings. There are five different curtains which are hung up at different times of the year, and each one has its own specific reason. The one hanging now, which is in a golden weave, has woven into it 10 menorahs, which depict the 10 menorahs which Shlomo HaMelech added to the Holy Temple when he built the Holy Temple. Every number in the shul has a meaning. It corresponds to either a halachic detail or a Kabbalistic realm, like even the amount of lighting in the shul. There's 112 light bulbs in every chandelier, which corresponds to the numerical value of three different names of God, in Hebrew lettering, of course. Even the 96 spotlights in the roof is also a special numerical value in the Kabbalistic learnings. And the same thing for many, many other things in the shul. Every number has a Kabbalistic meaning corresponding to it.
I said when I walked in that this place is awe-inspiring. Well, I'm now standing in front of a golden gate which closes off the entrance to the Holy Ark, the Ark in which the Torah scrolls are kept. And when you stand in front of it, you can really see this enormous size. It's plain, and yet it's opulent. It's difficult to describe. It gives a feeling of eminence. All it has over the top is a golden crown. And as we heard, I didn't see any inscriptions.
First of all, as you see the stairs going up to the Aron Kodesh, you have 9 stairs, plus the level where the Sefer Torah are lying, Torah scrolls, that's 10 different levels, and that corresponds to the 10 spheres in Kabbalah, one of the foundations in Hasidus. The gates around the Aron Kodesh were also in bells, in the original bells of Shul, and that's to like divide between the holiness of the Shul and the extra holiness of the Aron Kodesh, and that people shouldn't go up here for no reason, only when the Kohanim bless the people and to take out the Torah scrolls, of course. So that's why it's gated off completely, and a whole week it's locked. If you notice, we just went down a little step where the Baal Tefillah, the one that leads the prayer, stands. We find this in shuls in Prague as well, in other shuls, reinstating the minhag, the halacha, that the one that leads the prayers should go down a step when he prays, as it says in Psalms, from the depths I will call out to you. So one that leads the prayers goes down a little step. Here we have the what we call the Shivisi Hashem. There's a plaque here in front of where the Chazan stands, which says the Hashem's name, Yud Kei Vov Kei, which is made of gold leaf, it's called, which is a... And now this has many kilos of gold in it. And the reason that they made this out of gold goes back to a story which was by the third Rebbe of Belz, who was in the times of the First World War. And the Russians came in 1914, and he had to escape, and he was for several years in exile. And when he came back, he found the shul very neglected. The Russians had used the shul as a hospital. And, of course, it had to be refurbished, and there was no money at that time, so he just put up God's name of wood. And he remarked that in his shul in Jerusalem will have the name of God in gold. So, like, to make his words come true, so to speak, they have this here made of gold. And these are the only words you'll find in the shul, because this is mentioned in the halacha, that these words should be in front of the one that leads the prayers.
Every synagogue has a rabbi who is spiritual leader of that particular synagogue. Who is the rabbi here?
You asked a very good question. Actually, in Belz, it's a little different than every other Hasidus. In every Hasidus, you have a rabbi, you have a rabbi as well, but you have a rabbi. Here, the Belz rabbis are called Belzer Ruf, because they are also rabbis and rabbis, and you have here the seat of the Belz Rebbe. Just if you look at the chair, you'll see the chair is facing congregants, and usually the Rebbes sit with their face to the wall. So here in Belz, because the Rebbe is as well a rabbi, so his chair faces the congregants, and he actually serves as the spiritual leader in all the issues of the Hasidus.
Well, can you explain to me then the difference between a rabbi and the rebbe, or as you have, a rof?
Okay, usually the difference would be that a rabbi has in mind all functions of the community down to the last detail. He has to make sure that that there is kosher food provided for the community. He presides over all the marriages. And all social religious functions, he's in charge of these things. While a rebbe is more of a spiritual leader, teaching his disciples the ways of God and the ways to serve God with joy and repent if someone does something wrong, and more leading people in the spiritual elevation of their daily service of God. The Belzer Rebbe, which is also a rabbi, does both things. He's in charge of all the religious needs of the community, besides for also serving as a rebbe, which is teaching and urging the Hasidim to strengthen their service of God in every way and at all times. If you take a look at the rebbe's place, you'll see it's the same type of chair, and it's actually joined on to all the other chairs in the shul. That's unusual, because usually the rebbe sitts on a special chair. The first Belzer Rebbe also sat on the same bench as the people of the rest of the community. He said that was to imply that he is a part of the community and his prayers go up together with everyone else's, and he doesn't want to be divided from the rest of the community. The previous Belzer Rebbe, all his children were murdered in the war, and he arrived in Eretz Yisrael in 1944. With his entire Hasidus destroyed and decimated completely. All that was left to the Belzer dynasty was the Rebbe and one younger brother. Now, this younger brother had a child here in Israel in 1948, leaving the Rebbe, Rebbe Aaron, and a little boy of 2 years old. That was all that was left to the Belzer Hasidus. Rebbe Aaron passed away, and when this little boy became 18 years old, in 1966 he was crowned as Belzer Rebbe. And the first thing he declared when he became Rebbe was that it's his task to rebuild the Belzer Synagogue here in Yerushalayim, and all over the world the Belzer communities are rebuilt. The Rebbe says that this is nothing short of a miracle, and he prescribes this miracle all in the merit of his uncle, Rebbe Aaron Rokeach.
I understand that I can't see the open doors of the Ark and look at the Torah scrolls. Why?
Well, to open the Ark, when it's not necessary to actually take out the Sefer Torah, is considered an unnecessary usage of the Sefer Torah, which is not permitted in Halacha. So that's why it remains closed, sites for when they actually take out the Sefer Torah. So now it's locked and it's kept safely. But just to tell you an interesting point about the Sefer Torah, which is different to all other places in the world, here in Belzer, Sefer Torah lies flat down on a shelf. There is actually a conflicting opinions whether Sefer Torah should be lying flat or standing upright. And in the whole world, it's accepted that the Sefer Torah should be standing upright. The rabbi in Belz, before the Belzer Rebbes came on the scene, was called the Bach, and he takes on the opinion that the Sefer Torah should be lying flat. So the minhag of the town remained, and that's why in the main shul in Belz as well, the Sefer Torah are flat on shelves.
Well, that's certainly most interesting. I am, however, permitted to ascend the Bima, the elevated place from where I'm in the middle of this great synagogue, and from here you get a tremendous view, and also I'm very close to one of the chandeliers, and I can see now how extraordinary large it is. On the table, I can see a rubber cushion and what looks to me like a big wooden spoon one might stir washing with.
Yes, that's to serve a very important purpose. Because, as I said, the acoustics in the shul are very powerful. Chassidim pray very loud. So the one that leads the prayers has a little difficulty in raising his voice above everyone else's. So as he's about to finish a portion and start the next portion, and people have to know where they're holding, which way the one that leads the prayers is up to, they have a gabai, which is a sectern standing on the bima, and he holds his spoon in his hands, and he gives a bang. like that, and that quietens down all the other people, and one hears clearly the Baal Tefillah, the one that leads the prayers, completing the portion where he's up to and continuing on, so that way everyone davens in formation and everyone knows where they're meant to be holding at this particular point. If you look around at all the walls, there are windows. Now in the halacha it says one should have 12 windows in a shul corresponding to the 12 tribes of Israel. In this shul there are more than 12 windows, but there are all sets of 12. You have 12 closed up windows, and they're called in Yiddish verstopte fensters. According to the Kabbalah, the prayers go up through close-up windows, and that's how it was in Bells as well, and it's been reinstated in the shul as well.
This movement originated in a little place called Belz in Galicia, today's southeastern Poland, which was once a part of Austria, and Jews lived and prayed there for ages. But when was the movement established?
The Hasidic movement of Belz was established 200 years ago by the first Belzer Rebbe. His name was Reb Shulam Rokeach.
This is a worldwide organization. How does one become a member?
It's not based on a membership. Anyone that accepts the Belzer Rebbe as his spiritual leader is automatically a Belzer Chosid. If he sends his children to the Belzer schools and the Belzer yeshivot, so obviously he's part of the community.
Is it necessary to dress in this black outfit that Belzer Hasidim usually wear?
Necessary is, of course, not. But one which belongs to this community will obviously feel that he would like not to stick out. And he'll probably put on what everyone else wears. And this dress originates going back 200 years, so we haven't changed. 50% of the Belzer Hasidim live in Israel, and another 50% live all over the world. Wherever there is a stronghold of religious Jews, you will find a Belzer Shtibul, a Belzer Shul.
Can you give me a brief definition of Hasidic movement? Not necessarily only Belz, but what does it mean? How would you explain what Hasidim are?
That's, as you said, quite a difficult question to answer. Hasidim put in the emotional enthusiasm into the mitzvahs which they do. They serve God with tremendous enthusiasm and joy, like a son serves a father more than a servant serves a king.
I mentioned earlier that you conduct tours. Are they at regular times?
To make a tour, you have to make an appointment.
How long does a tour take, and what is the cost?
A tour takes approximately an hour, and there is actually no cost. But usually people would like to contribute towards the upkeep of the shul, so they leave a donation.
Is the synagogue open for individuals to come by themselves? Because among the many important sites and structures the visitor to Jerusalem ought to visit is certainly this one, the Belzer Synagogue.
Unfortunately, one cannot come and see the shul, the main section of the shul, by themselves in the middle of the week.
I suppose it's okay then to turn up for services on a Friday night or a Saturday morning.
Yes, most certainly. The shul is open and you'll be able to find a place to sit on a regular Shabbat, Friday night and Shabbat morning.
I know that you are very concerned that visitors should be modestly dressed when entering the building. For ladies, that means covering bare shoulders, wearing sleeves at least over the elbows, I take it, and of course no shorts and preferably skirts to below the knee. For men, obviously, no t-shirts or shorts, but many ladies always wear pants or jeans. Is that all right for a visitor?
The answer is no. We cannot let into the shul someone that comes with pants or jeans. So one, to be able to see the shul, one would have to come with skirts going down below the knees, and that includes a hair covering and stockings, etc.
I've entered a Beit HaMidrash, a prayer hall. The sanctuary, as you heard, is not in use. On weekdays, people conduct their services here. And between the services, people are learning Torah and learning about Judaism, their books, people sitting together in groups or by themselves, as you can hear in the background.
There is too much interference by diaspora Jewry in Israel's internal affairs. How dare some 575 rabbis, my number this week, sitting in their comfortable suburban homes in the US and Canada, tell us how to deal with the phenomenon of LGBT and surrogacy? As rabbis, they should concentrate to minister to their own communities. And here is my thought for this week. If an issue does not directly concern you, don't interfere. That's all I have time for this week. So until we meet again, when I bring you more news, views, and interviews from Israel and the rest of the Jewish world, this is Walter Bingham wishing you a good and happy week. And please remember that there are thousands of elderly people who have to sit and eat alone. Please visit them and make their day. Goodbye.
Where can you get the inside news on Israel? At Israel News Talk Radio, we're dedicated to sharing Israel's inside story with the world by providing our listeners with news on Israeli politics, current affairs, and Israeli Jewish culture. The Israel News Talk Radio homepage also provides you, the listener, with useful information at your fingertips, with scrolling news headlines, weather, currency exchange, Shabbat candlelighting times, and so much more. Our radio programming is always accessible and on demand. We operate absolutely free of charge for everyone, everywhere. If you love what we do, partner with us now by becoming an Israel News Talk Radio supporter. With your support, you'll be inscribed on our Israel News Talk Radio Wall of Fame. There's nothing like us in the world. Be part of something great. Israel News Talk Radio, straight talk from Israel. Where can you get the inside news on Israel? At Israel News Talk Radio, we're dedicated to sharing Israel's inside story with the world by providing our listeners with news on Israeli politics, current affairs, and Israeli Jewish culture. The Israel News Talk Radio homepage also provides you, the listener, with useful information at your fingertips, with scrolling news headlines, weather, currency exchange, Shabbat candlelighting times, and so much more. Our radio programming is always accessible and on demand. We operate absolutely free of charge for everyone, everywhere. If you love what we do, partner with us now by becoming an Israel News Talk Radio supporter. With your support, you'll be inscribed on our Israel News Talk Radio Wall of Fame. There's nothing like us in the world. Be part of something great. Israel News Talk Radio, straight talk from Israel.
News, opinion, and more. You're listening to Israel News Talk Radio.